Hi, everybody. My name is Kathy Heekin, and I am recovering one day at a time in the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon Family Groups. You know, I have to teach school tomorrow. It's our first day of school, and so that's why I have to leave here, really, literally, in about an hour. And Dinah has agreed to take me up to LAX because that's the plane I could. That's the only plane that's going to get me back to Cincinnati in time to welcome these, 18-year-olds that I have to face tomorrow morning. But it'll be great. But tomorrow, when I realized this, when Barbara called and said, you know, it's a Sunday night, and I thought, oh my God, the next day is the first day of school. You know, that thought only stayed my mind for like a second, because there are so many of you out here that I know and that I have been with before and that I like so much, and you're so far away, I don't really get to see you all that often. And so it really was a no-brainer as far as I was concerned. So what if I'll sleep on the plane and then teach tomorrow, big deal. I mean, it'll be great. And really, tomorrow morning, when I stumble off that plane, just remembering this wonderful sponsored banquet will be enough for me. Because, these are the moments for me. These are the things that really, these memories that I have of being with women who have what I want. These are the things, these are the memories that get me through those days that are not always so easy, and those times that sometimes can be tough. You are an inspiration to me and the women that I know in Cincinnati and in other places in this country. You inspire me. And when I feel like quitting, remembering you and the memory of you keeps me going. And so for that, I'm really very, very grateful. Barbara and Sally picked me up at the airport yesterday, and as Barbara said, we have had 1 week of fun in one day. I mean, we have raced and ran, and I can't believe how hot it is. Yikes! But I've had a great time and wonderful hospitality. And actually, if anything would go wrong, I had to make arrangements at home. If anything should go wrong, like the plane's delayed or canceled, I had to find a sub that I'm going to call 11 o'clock your time. I don't know what time that is in Cincinnati. I think it's about 2 in the morning. But I had a hard time trying to find a sub who would go in and sub on the very first day of school, with seniors. So my friends who haven't started yet to teach in the public school were like, well, gee, that's my last week. And so finally I got a friend in the program. She's a police dispatcher. So she's on call, and she said to me, well, I've never taught seniors. What do I do if they misbehave? And I said, well, call 911. What else are you going to do? So actually, I said yes, really, for some selfish reasons. But as the day came closer, what happened was this. I sponsored this young woman in Cincinnati who's going through a terrible time, actually. In her marriage, there's just been a severe breakdown of trust. And last Friday, a week ago Friday, she called me and she said, will you be home this afternoon? I have to leave work. I'm falling apart here at work. Can I come over? And I said, certainly. And she came over and she sat on my porch. And I don't know about you guys, but once when I was in the South, these older women, I heard them say this prayer, God, sit on my tongue. And sometimes with women that I sponsor who just really, they have a lot to say and they have a lot of pain, I say to myself as I'm listening to them, God, sit on my tongue. Sit on my tongue and just allow me to be present. Because as my own sponsor said to me a number of times, sometimes when you're dealing with alcoholism, there's just no inoculation for the pain. There's no inoculation for the pain. And oftentimes I think the most sacred thing we do for one another is to be with one another in our pain and in our grief. Those of us that have been in for a while know that eventually that will pass, but there is the importance of walking through it. And to be able to walk through it with someone, for me, is a great honor as a human being. But anyway, as I was sitting there on my front porch listening to her, I thought to myself, there was a convention in Cincinnati last weekend, and I knew that Pat R. was coming in from Oceanside to speak. So I said to her, you know, Ann, what are you doing tomorrow? Well, I was going to do this, I was going to do that. And I said, no, Ann, this is what we're going to do tomorrow. We're going to go to the convention tomorrow, and we're going to listen to Pat R. from Oceanside, California speak, and everything will be all right. And it's just, you know, that's just such a thrill to know that that, and there she met me the next morning. We went in, and I mean, Pat, I've heard her before, and she's always terrific. But you know when you really want somebody to really, really be terrific, and then they're even more terrific than you'd even hope they'd be? I mean, it really took me a lot of effort to stay in my seat, because I just wanted to keep jumping up and saying, that's right, Pat, that's right. Say that again. Say that again, sister. So, really, Pat, you were terrific. You just were terrific. The other thing is this. We have a beginner's meeting at our at my home group. My home group is the Tuesday night Mount Washington 12-step group. It starts at 8 o'clock if you're ever in Cincinnati and you need a good meeting. Well, about 4 or 5 years ago, those of us that are on the steering committee were whining about nobody was saying the right things at the meeting. It really drove us crazy. And so at this meeting, we were thinking, you know, I seem to think that we'd be much better off if we offered a beginner's meeting, because we weren't doing that. And this other woman, this friend of mine, thought we'd be much better off if we really, really pushed sponsorship. So what we decided to do was to have beginner meetings that really, really pushed sponsorship. And honest to God, the meeting has done a wonderful turnaround, and it's better than ever. But I generally do the fourth Tuesday of the month. But the girl that takes the third Tuesday was sick, so she called me last Tuesday and she said, would you take my place? And I said, sure, because I love to do beginners. And I really do. I don't know if you've ever done a beginner. Did you ever do a beginner? Sometimes you feel like going to yourself, what? So I went, and there was just this young kid. I thought he was 17. Actually, he was 30. He was married and had two kids. And he came from an alcoholic home, and he said what brought him there was that his wife said, you know, you are living with you is living with is like living with someone that's emotionally dead. I cannot do it anymore. And so he didn't know what to do, but he remembered that his parents had been in AA, and so he thought that he would go to Al-Anon. And so this young 31-year-old came. The other person that was there was a grandmother who was in her 70s. And she came because her granddaughter had just been put in a rehab center. So here I am with this woman, this older woman in her 70s, who's there for her granddaughter, and this 31-year-old kid who is there, he thinks, for his wife and his two children. And you know, I give my spiel, and Debbie, who does it with me, was doing her thing. And then you open it up. And to listen to these two go back and forth, sharing their stories, you know, why they're there. And then it almost seemed as though Debbie and I took a back seat, and these two began to minister to one another. The young kid said, you know, I really have no idea what feelings I have. I don't know when the last time it is that I felt a feeling. And then this grandmother said, well, that's why I'm here. I'm concerned about my granddaughter. But more importantly, I'm concerned about my grandson. Ever since my granddaughter's begun drinking, he's just withdrawn more and more and more. And I'm afraid he will grow up, and this young kid said, like me. And I sat there and I thought, if a beginner's meeting isn't a sacrament, they ought to make it one. Because what a privilege and an honor it is to be a part of a recovery program that reaches from the youngest to the oldest. And to know with certainty that if you're willing to give yourself to this program, and if you are capable of honesty, everything will be all right. There is a prayer that I heard once a long time ago, and it says that dear God, give me the kind of faith that when I am living on the edge of light in my life, I can step out into the circle of darkness around me and know that I will surely step on firm ground, or that you will teach me how to fly. And that's the kind of faith, and that's the kind of hope that I believe this program brings to all of us. And that's why for me, you know, to come out here, to take a red eye back and to teach is really nothing. It's nothing. It's a drop in the bucket compared to what I have been given. Some of you have heard my story before, so I'm going to just zip through a lot of it, I think. Oh, maybe I won't then. All right, you talked me into it. But, you know, I was reading in our Courage to Change book just recently the importance of looking back at the past but not staring at it. And I love that line, you know, the importance of looking at the past but not staring at it. And this summer, on my mother's side of the family, we had this huge family reunion. I've never had one before in Cincinnati. And those of us that live in Cincinnati knew we had to host it, although most of our people are from the East Coast. It wasn't even our idea, and we thought, oh, no. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. And one of the East Coast people took it upon herself to do this huge family tree from, you know, really back, we are not over here very long from Ireland, but she did this family tree that began hundreds of years ago in Ireland all the way up to present day. And my brother pointed out, he was master of ceremonies, he pointed out that in that entire family tree from hundreds of years ago in Ireland, there was not one divorce. And then he said, I think that means that our family has either been incredibly lucky in love, or we have a tremendous capacity for suffering. Well, I don't know. All I know is this. I don't know that I was raised really any differently than a lot of women I know my age. I mean, I got the same messages that most of my friends got, and particularly for a woman, and that was, you know, don't get angry, don't feel sorry for yourself. It was always important when I grew up how things looked. My mother always was concerned about the neighbors. I mean, I don't even know who the neighbors were, but it was very important that we do nothing, you know, that would embarrass us as a family. My mother would always say, everything will turn out all right. It will be fine. Rise above it. Rise above it. That was a big, you know, that was a big lesson, to rise above it. And my schooling, I mean, I really did. I had over 16 years of a Catholic education. And I was raised by these really good, you know, good nuns. But one thing that they used to really, really, I believe, teach because they believed in it, and that was, you know, the absolute value of suffering. But but it didn't count if you complained about it, you know. And it was just like it never happened. It had to be silent suffering. And I, you know, that's what I heard. I don't know what they really said, but that's what I heard, that if you were really a good woman, you did for others, you put others before yourself. If you had one thing, you ripped it in half and shared it always. If you didn't have enough food, God forbid you'd be the first one in line. You'd have to be the last. And then only so you could offer to clean up after everybody else. And that was the way to true happiness, you know, absolute self-sacrifice and suffering. And that was, you know, that was the golden ring. That was the golden ring. Now, there was something in me that always liked people that, you know, like if you, in the summer we always go up to the East Coast, you know, when little kids build sand castles, for example, there's some sick thing about me. I always liked those boys that would come by and smash all the sand castles, you know? I just thought that was so awful, it was attractive to me, you know? Even today, I have this horrible dog that, and I really, well, he is. He's not a very good dog. And actually, I even got this book somebody lent me that monks had written that says there are no bad dogs. And I tried to train this thing, and I thought I did a very nice job, and then I went away for a while. I went away for like a week, and when I came back, my kids, don't know what my kids have done to this dog in a week, but everything I taught him, he had forgotten. So if you even open the door a little bit, that dog runs away. And what he likes to do is he likes to get as far away from you as possible and sit. And then as you come right tearing down the street, he sits there until you're that far from him, and then he just takes off and goes to the other end. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. So this dog is a bad dog. But the cute little couple across the street, they have a dog. They took, of course, their dog to obedience school. Their dog, on Sunday morning, they open their front door, and the dog walks dutifully down the steps, puts the paper in his mouth, and walks back up the steps and hands it to Mr. and Mrs. Perfect Couple. And every time I see him do it, I want to go, run, Fido! Run for the traffic! You're free! Get out of here! Run! I just want him to do some awful thing, or to turn around and drop the paper and then bite him in the ankles. Anything. But I don't know why that is. There are my brothers and sisters. There are six of us. I don't know that the rest of them feel that way, but I think that they do. My father was a newscaster, and he would always come home with outrageous stories about people that did horrible things. And he always spoke of them with a measure of admiration. Really, there's something about a woman that would chop up her husband into pieces and put him in a trunk and mail him to Cleveland. That's a woman that's inventive. You know what I mean? So it's no wonder when my oldest son joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was cleaning his room, and he was only 15, and I picked up his big book, just a page through it, and when I opened it, he had carved out the whole inside of the book, and inside were the second set of keys to my car. I knew somebody was taking that car, because in the morning when I would go out, it would be splattered with mud. But I could never figure out who had the keys. And there they were. Now, see, I like that about this kid. I think that shows promise. So anyway, I'm going to miss my plane. So that's what I got going on, But me, not me, man. I'm always following the rules. I'm being good. That's just the way that I was raised, to do what I was told to do, and if something went wrong, hey, it's fine. Hey, no, really, that's fine. Oh, you backed up into my car. Hey, no problem. I didn't really like this car much anyway. No, really, go on. Don't worry yourself about it. I'm fine. And that's the way I live, and I truly believe that I would guarantee myself not only a wonderfully high place in heaven, but that I would really walk through life trouble-free. You reap what you sow. Those are the things that I learned as a kid. And if you are good to people, people will be good to you. And to tell you the truth, there is a lot of really wonderful gems that I got as a kid that Al-Anon has restored to me. That a lot of good things that I learned that I threw out totally, and the program has recovered those for me. We have at my house this little poster that a friend of mine brought back from Ireland that says, being Irish, he had an abiding sense of tragedy, which sustained him through temporary moments of joy. And I don't know what it is. My mother will even say this. She and I went out to Seattle to visit one of my kids who was graduating from high school there. That's odd, you say to yourself, a high school kid. I wonder how that happened. She lives in Cincinnati, and the kids graduate. But you, of course, know what happened. So my mother and I were going out to Seattle, and I picked her up for this wonderful trip. As she got in the car, she looked at her house, and she said to me, "Boy, I hope my house doesn't burn down before we get home." I said, "Mom, why would you say that?" And she said, "I don't know." That's the kind of thinking that I come from. So, when I met my husband, he was one of those guys that would trample on the sandcastles at the beach. But I thought that was funny. There were a lot of things he did that I thought were just really funny, because they were things that I would never have dreamt of doing. But there was always a piece in me that wanted to do it. For example, if we went out to eat dinner and he ordered a steak rare and it was medium rare, he would complain and send it back. I would eat something that was moving on my plate rather than complain. So I liked those things about him. I considered all those things that I saw in him as being extremely brave and adventuresome. He was, when we started dating, he was in training to become a Marine Corps pilot. And he flew jets. I mean, and that was during Vietnam, and not many guys who went into flight school got the jets. A lot of them got the helicopters, but not he. He got the jets. And I thought that was so exciting. And he would sometimes get a hop into Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton. And I would drive up to Dayton, and I would park there, and then I'd see these jets coming in and land, and the canopy would pop up, and he would jump out of the plane. Oh, my God. I mean, really. I mean, put Genghis Khan in the cockpit, and I would have been, you know, take me to Arabia. I mean, to the desert. Oh, my God, what was I thinking? Anyway, the thing that really clinched it for me, and I've told this story a million times, but I have to repeat it because it really did clinch it for me. He grew up with a father that raised quarter horses, and he always knew a lot about riding and horses, and he had friends that also were horse people. And so once on a date, there was a group of us from Cincinnati that were going to go over to Indiana to ride horses at another friend's horse farm. And when we got over there, one of the guys, who had never been around horses, he thought he'd take the biggest, baddest horse and saddle it and impress his girlfriend. So he got into a stall with this really wild, what I consider to be a wild horse, and he got into trouble. I mean, he, you know, bit off more than he could chew, and he got stuck in this horse. I don't know if the horse sensed his fear or what, but the horse had him trapped and was bucking and moving, and the guy was calling for help. Well, everybody called for Rick. Get Rick, get Rick, get Rick. Well, you know, I loved that. I mean, Rick was my date. And so, really. And so Rick, he got into the stall with this crazed horse, reached around the horse's neck, grabbed its ear, and bit its ear. And paralyzing the horse, which that will do. It would paralyze you, I'm sure. Well, I tell you, I saw that and I thought, that's the guy I want to spend the rest of my life with. I mean, what could go wrong, really? I mean, from horses to jets, he'll take care of it all. And then I can sit back and read books and smoke cigarettes and not have to worry about confrontation, which I dread. You know, he'll just take care of everything. It'll be terrific. And so we got married. We got married very quickly because he had orders to go to Vietnam. We just didn't know when they would be. So we thought it would be a good idea to get married before he left for Vietnam. I'll tell you, 22-year-old thinking is really a dangerous thing. So we got married, he left for Vietnam, but I'll tell you the truth, we were not even married 2 weeks, and I knew I was in over my head. We were not even married 2 weeks, and I knew that I was in over my head. And I could tell you a million different things that happened, but what was most important for me is that I got scared. And I did not grow up in a scary home. I grew up in a pretty funny home with two very funny parents and a lot of funny brothers and sisters. And fear was not something that I was used to. But there were things that happened, things that I didn't understand, and in order to make sense of them, the only thing I knew to do was to believe that I had caused them. Because I just didn't know how else to make sense of it, you know, this anger that would come out of nowhere. We would go to these squadron parties and everybody else's husband would be pretty funny and mine would become dangerous, and I just got scared. I just had a sense that I was in over my head, because you see, I always thought, truly I did, I mean I knew that he had a bad temper before I married him, but you know, I just believed that once we actually started living together, once you really had gone through a marriage, that would all change. That my presence in his life would have such a calming effect that whatever it was he was always so mad about, he just wouldn't be there anymore, you know? That I would really be able to smooth his feathers. And plus, to tell you the truth, when I'm honest about it, it would be such a feather in my cap to be married to such an outrageous guy and to be able to tame him. You know, I thought that I could do that. I thought that I would be able to do that. And within really 2 weeks, I knew that that was not going to happen. And maybe not at all, but it certainly wasn't going to happen, you know, very easily. So within 10 days, I was already making plans to leave. Within 10 days, I thought, you know what, you're in over your head, you better get out of here. But what stopped me that day, it stopped me for the next 12 and a half years until I found you, and that was, how will that look? How will that look? 10 days, you're married, and then you bail out? I mean, what a loser. How will that look? So I did what I could do. I just pretended. I pretended like I wasn't afraid. I pretended like I wasn't living in a panic. I pretended like I had the answers. And I really pretended like everything was just fine. This was great. I couldn't have written a better script. This is terrific. This is just terrific. Here I am living in a trailer in North Carolina, 1,000 miles away from anybody that I know or love and care about, and I'm living with a madman. But you know what? This is great. This is going to be an adventure. I am so happy. And that's what I did. And after we were married in January, and I got pregnant in February, and he was on his way to Vietnam by May. And I went back to Cincinnati, and the very first thing I did was I called the priest that had married us. And as I headed out the door to talk to him, I'll never forget my mother saying to me, "I hope you're not going to tell him anything personal." Hey, yikes! I mean, really, I'm a bride, and I'm already looking for help. And I didn't stop until I found you. But this is what's really interesting, is that every place that I went from there until I found Al-Anon, you know, I'd listen, and I'd think, yeah, but you just knew, or I knew, that wasn't the answer. I mean, this priest said, you know, learn to take a back seat, and I'd think, yeah, well, I don't believe that's going to work. You know, the psychologist would say, well, learn to speak in I statements. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, when you're living with a disease, you just know speaking in I statements isn't going to cure it. I mean, you just know, especially the I statements I was using. I hate you. That was my I statement. So anyway, things are bad. I know they're bad, but I'm trying real hard. And I'm thinking, well, I've got a year now, you know. I've got a year. Well, he's in Vietnam. I'll figure this out. Give me a year. So I hang out a lot with his sisters, you know, and we talk about his childhood, and I try to find a key in there, and, you know, I hang out with his friends, not always be listening, you know, trying to pick up evidence. And actually, that's really what I spent a lot of years doing when I was married. I was gathering evidence, you know, building a case, so that finally if I had to leave, you'd understand why I had to leave. And that's really, that's a terrible way to be married. That's a terrible way to be married. Gathering evidence, building a case. I always felt like I had one foot in the door and one foot out. I was never married those first 12 and a half years with both my feet firmly in that marriage. Every time an ugly thing would happen, I'd think, this is it. This is it. This is big enough to leave. This is big enough to leave. This is a big enough event to call for a divorce. And the next day, see, then I doubt myself. Oh, maybe it's not. Maybe everybody has this in their marriage. You know, I used to listen very carefully to other women. I really would. And whenever they would say something like, oh, my husband was so mean last night, I'd think, oh, see, all husbands are mean sometimes. I was always listening to see what everybody else said. Because I had no idea that I had a right to live better. I had no idea that I had a right to live better. And yet, there was always something in me. There was always something in me, some small voice that never got totally drowned out, that was saying to me, I want you to be happy, joyous, and free. And I couldn't believe that the God of my understanding wanted this life for me. But it made no sense that I couldn't figure a way how to fix it. It made no sense. So for the whole year he was gone, I worked so hard at trying to figure out certain words I could say, something that I could do. You know, maybe what was I doing wrong? Maybe I was a wimp. Maybe I should try being tough. Maybe I should learn to confront him. Maybe I should do this. Maybe I should do that. Maybe I should learn to fly a jet. Maybe I'll just have to be braver. You know, it's a million things that I was trying to do in order to fix this. I have this friend of mine. His daughter has been a cocaine addict for a while. And, you know, she knows I go to Al-Anon. She says it's not for her. She doesn't relate. She lives over in Kentucky. And, you know, I bring her literature. I've offered to take her to meetings with her. I'll bring her to Cincinnati. I'll go to Kentucky. She's not interested. But she did say this to me a few months ago. She said, I can't understand why my daughter would do this. We were such good parents. We went to all of her soccer games. We went to all the PTA meetings. We were really good parents. We were always there for her. How could this happen? And I said to her, Judy, if your daughter had cancer, you would never sit down and say, how could this happen? We went to all of her soccer games. We showed up at PTA. How could she get cancer? This is a disease. I did not understand that for the first 12 and a half years of my marriage. I took everything personally. I took everything that he did and said personally. I thought it was my fault. I would live with a great sense of injustice. My kids always say, Mom, you were waiting for the clue bus without a ticket. And that's exactly what it was like for 12 and a half years, waiting for the clue bus without a ticket. Until I found you. I knew there was something wrong with me. I was with these other wives whose husbands were on their way to Vietnam. They were very upset and distraught. I couldn't wait for him to leave. And I had only been married for 4 months. And I knew that wasn't normal. They were just distraught. And then when he was over there, people would say, oh, are you worried about him flying over there? I was never worried about him flying over there because I knew he would be fine. Mean people are always well taken care of. But I used to think, and I've said this before, I used to think that maybe if you were captured and tortured a little bit, it might help him realize or feel your experience. So anyway, I'm desperate, and I was desperate quickly, to tell you the truth. I mean, I really, sometimes I envy women that'll say, well, we were married for about 10 years, and then he started to drink. See, I really, out of the gate, I knew I was in trouble. Out of the gate, I knew I was in trouble. And I just didn't know what to do. I exhausted myself trying to come up with solutions. But my real work was keeping what was going on in my house away from you. Because what would you think of me if you knew what I was living with? And so it became very important to me that you never know what was going on. Now, I used to like to think I was protecting him, but the truth of the matter is I really wasn't protecting him at all. I was protecting me. I was protecting me and my reputation as a wife, as a mother, and as a woman. I did not want you to know what I was living with because of what you would think of me. And that's why I covered, and that's why I lied, and I became very good at that. I became very good at putting on a very happy face, telling a lot of jokes about him, making him sound like he was the most fun person in the world to live with. He was my best material for years. He was my best material. I mean, I could tell Rick Eakin stories, so I was blue in the face, and everybody would be laughing. My high school friends, we play bridge still to this day. They'd be howling and hooting as I left, and I'd go home in tears. I'd go home in tears because I had so much fun with my women friends, and I had to return. I had to return to the House of Usher. That's what I used to call my home, the House of Usher. So I came back from Vietnam. I tried everything that I knew, tried to be joyful, tried to be efficient, and nothing really worked. Nothing really worked. My husband decided to go, when he got out of the service, he decided to become a dentist. And I don't know how, we were talking about that on the way up, I don't know how you go from being a jet pilot to a dentist, but I don't know, he was going to use the GI Bill, and right before he went to dental school at Ohio State in Columbus, Ohio, he got into a very bad fight over in Kentucky in a bar, and he was beaten badly by a bouncer who had brass knuckles, injured him. He had to have plastic surgery before we left for dental school so he could see out of one eye. And I don't know what it did to him, but while we were at Ohio State, he didn't drink. For 3 years, he didn't drink. Now, I thought he didn't drink because of me. Because I had been patient and loving and never complained and suffered silently. And I thought, see, my God, this really does work. This is great. This is all paying off now. See how wise I was to stick in there? See how, good it was for me never to complain? This is terrific. And after he got out of dental school, we moved back to Cincinnati. His behavior became stranger than ever. Now, what's dangerous about me is that when his behavior would get out of whack, mine would match it. Because I'm always trying to stay one step ahead of him. And so in order to try to figure out what he was going to do or what he was going to say, I had to learn to think like him, and that made me crazy. That really made me crazy. I mean, when he would come in the door, I would have to gauge how he was so I would know how to be. If he came in the door and he had a bad day and he was mean, then I had to make sure that all the kids were out of the way, and I had to make sure that everything was perfect, and I'd never tell him anything his mother or father had said because that would make him mad. And I mean, it was so much work. It was exhausting. It just exhausted me. But I just wanted to keep the peace, and I couldn't. And what I found out later was, now that he was a dentist, he was beginning to write prescriptions for himself. And I never could find any alcohol, and I never did find any pills. But the narcotic unit in Cincinnati found the pills, and they arrested him, and they kicked him out of dentistry for a while. Now, interestingly enough, none of that ever hit the newspapers, even though it was during a time where there was a lot of publicity about doctors and dentists, you know, getting busted for having illegal writing of prescriptions. But his story never hit print, and so that meant that we could keep it a secret. So now, you know, I always think if I ever went into advertising, I'd probably make a fortune, because now I got to package this. I mean, he's been a dentist for, I think he's only a dentist for 8 months before he's arrested and thrown out, and I got to make it seem like this guy is just so adventuresome and such a maverick in his field that he couldn't possibly be a dentist. And so he just had to quit because he was just too bored. And so he decided to become a fox hunter. Now, that sounds crazy to you, but I used to tell that like it was the most logical thing in the world, and everybody would sit there and go, yeah, yeah, I don't know what they thought when I left, so that's what he did. And, you know, again, as the emphasis for me is the lengths that I was willing to go to keep what was going on a secret from you, from his family, from my family, and most particularly, from my children. I, as best I could, spent all my energy from the time I woke up until I fell down exhausted in the bed trying to make this thing work and make it look like it was just great, like I had picked the life of my dreams. That's really what was important to me, is that what you saw was this wonderfully happy, adventuresome woman who just loved living a life with a man who hunted fox for a living. And wasn't that great? And thank God he wasn't a dentist anymore. Why, what would we do with all that money? This is great, you know? This is just great. And what really made it difficult is, because we had no money, his family all lived on this compound with these quarter horses, and you'd go up this beautiful driveway with a split rail fence, and when people in his family got to a certain age and could afford it, they were given, you know, some acres of land, and then they'd build a home for themselves. So all up and down this driveway are his brothers and sisters, you know, in their homes, and at the very end of the driveway is the main house where his parents lived, and then next to it's a little summer house where you could live until you'd saved enough money to build a big house. We lived in that little house for 10 years. I mean, I never got out of that house. It was really hard to try to make it look good, because we never moved beyond that little summer house. And actually, at the time, people were beginning to encroach, you know, the suburbs were cropping up alongside us. And so all these people that were not members of the family were moving in, and they just thought we were as weird as we could be. I mean, they'd say, well, what does your husband do? I mean, their husbands were lawyers and doctors and bankers, and I'd say, well, he's a fox hunter. Now, try to say that with a straight face. And I said, oh, he's a fox hunter. Because really, I mean, you know, 200 years ago, it was a great profession. But in the 1980s, for a fox hunter, and really the only house, of course, in the whole territory that still had steel leg hold traps right outside our house, you know. And when I got wind that the neighborhood women wouldn't let their children play at my house because of these steel leg hold traps, you know, I was highly insulted. And I used to call them the Stepford Wives. And why would they move out to the country if they were afraid of, you know, the leg hold traps? If you ever really, if a little kid steps in it, just open up its teeth and free the child. It's just leave a little bruise, that's all. So, you know, I'm just minimizing everything. I'm minimizing everything. And little by little, outrageous behavior is beginning to be very acceptable. And I'm thinking by now, in my twisted way of thinking, that to live with the unacceptable is really quite noble. It's really quite noble to be able to do that. Not many people can do it, but I could. You know, I could do it. I could face them until they started missing their pets. Now, that was a little tricky because he used to hunt at night with those infrared glasses, you know, right outside our house. And, you know, they'd call and want to know if I'd seen Bootsy, and I knew Bootsy was no longer walking in the land of the living. But I know how you said that to somebody and make it sound normal. And Rick would say, hey, listen, those are house cats. They have no right to be out hunting. And then, you know, this, and I think, that's right. They deserve to die. I mean, that's what happened to me, because the only way you can live, the only way I could live with it was to try to, you know, to make it, somehow make all that craziness make sense. That made me crazy. That made me crazy. So, well, the gist of it all is that one of the sisters on the driveway joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And then another sister on the driveway joined, and then another sister joined. And now, within 2 months, I've got 4 sister-in-laws who are all members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and actually still are today. And they have always been, those 4 women, very, very important to me, and still are today. Because when they got into AA, they really got into AA. And the very first thing they did was they got sponsors. They got sponsors. And they went to a lot of meetings, and they started working those steps. And they started sharing that. And they were up and down the driveway talking about the program and talking about alcoholism and talking about how it had been in the family for generations and how it was a family disease. Now, quite honestly, at that point, I was exhausted. I was spent. And I had been to so many places looking for help that when they came to me, and I always say, you know, we have a tradition, attraction rather than promotion. But, don't you believe it. They came looking for me. They came after me with their little books that I used to call the blue book just to make them mad. Then I would say, it's not a blue book, it's a big book. I'd say, okay, well, whatever your blue book says. But you know, I just thought, I've been everywhere. I've been to prayer groups, I've been to healers. I mean, I've been everywhere. Psychologists, social workers, blah, 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 blah. You know, since 3 months into my marriage. Now you're telling me I have to go to another place? I don't think so. I'm the sane one in the family. That's what I thought. That's what I thought. That's what I thought. And I was the woman who just the night before was in the kitchen reading a book, enjoying myself. And I was so afraid that if he ever saw me enjoying myself, he wouldn't want to get help. So I heard him coming in the door, and I took my book, and I thought, what am I going to do with it? And I threw it in an oven and closed the oven because I didn't want him ever to see me having fun. Because I thought if he saw how miserable he was making me, he'd get help. So I'm throwing books in the oven. I'm hanging up on my friends when I'm on the phone. But I think I'm the same one. So the reason that, to tell you the truth, what scared me was at this time, at this point, I'm pregnant with child number 7. And I'm thinking, oh, stop that. My God, didn't you ever do anything? Did you ever go overboard in any area of your life? So, we're talking about this being a family disease, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God. I always did this 8-year plan. I'm 4 years younger than Rick, and women generally outlive men by about 4 years, and I always had this 8-year plan that I, at the end of my life, I'd have these 8 years where I wouldn't have to cover, and I wouldn't have to make things up, and I wouldn't have to work so hard at making the rough road smooth for him. And now they're telling me this is a family disease, and I've got all these kids, and I thought, my God, I will never get away from this crazy behavior. And because I had such great fear about the future, I went to a meeting. I went to a beginner's Al-Anon meeting, and it was there that a woman told me that Al-Anon was a disease, that alcoholism was a disease. Sorry. Sisters in AA said to me the other day, no, she said to me a while ago, actually, you know, whenever there's a convention, I always, always go listen to the Al-Anon speaker. I said, really? She goes, oh, yes, it always makes me so grateful I drank. Anyway, so, So it is a disease. You can get it in cars, can't control, you can't cure. Never thought I caused it. Always thought I should be able to cure it. And that, to me, the very first, I know some people have had different experiences in Al-Anon. For some women that I know well, you know, the first year was tough, 2 years were tough. Not for me. My experience was that very first night I went to that meeting, I felt like the weight of the world had been lifted off my shoulders when that woman told me that that program was for me, so that I could recover from the effects of alcoholism, and that my husband's recovery was none of my business. And that's what I heard that first night. And I said, really, I could have done cartwheels, even though I was pregnant with child number 7. I could have done cartwheels out of that, because no one had ever told me that. I always thought it was my job, always, to fix this guy. And when I couldn't, what was wrong with me? Wasn't patient enough? Wasn't loving enough? Wasn't kind enough? Wasn't long-suffering enough? What was wrong with me? And here she is telling me, it's none of your business. You've got to get better. Give your children one healthy parent. That's what I heard. And I continued to go back to that meeting, and I heard let go and let God. I heard that I could go home, and I didn't have to be the keeper of truth and justice in that relationship, that I could simply say to my husband, well, you could be right. Huh, you could be right. And I could let it go, and that saved me hours of talking in a circle to somebody that really wasn't listening. It wasn't listening. And then I had all this time on my hands to do other things, to begin to discover things that I enjoyed. And you know what really scares me about this side of the disease is that I almost got missed because I was so good at appearing as though everything was fine, that I had everything in order, you know, everything was going my way, hey, this is great fun. I was so good at that. After 12 and a half years, I almost got missed. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen somebody that's been in and leaves us after a long period of time, but I saw somebody not so long ago, and it was not a pretty picture, because alcoholism is a fatal disease, and it's not just fatal to the drinker. It is also fatal to those of us who live with it and who don't get help. And we'll never die of cirrhosis of the liver, but we'll die another way. And many of us will go out blaming our lives on somebody else. And that's a terribly bitter and lonely way to go. And so for that, you know, I will always, always be grateful to Al-Anon. But I also know that I need to do what I'm told to do. Because I was not in the program long before I got a sponsor. And I have the same sponsor today that I did when I came in 18 years ago. And she has led me through many things in my life and continues to. She is the one, you know, that really led me to believe that this program could restore to me all those things that I had really lost. Because when I came, I really had lost so many things. I had lost my hope. I had lost my dreams. I had lost my dignity as a human being. And that's the price that most of us finally pay, our dignity as a human being. And she taught me that this program could give all those back to me and much, much more. What I had to do was simply make a decision, that I had to make a decision to turn my life and will over to the care of God. You know, my mother, and I like to mention this because it means a lot to me, my mother has this little thing on her refrigerator that says, reach up as far as you can to God, and He will reach down the rest of the way. And I have always believed that's true, and I found that to be true in this program, that if I'm willing to do what I am told to do, and if I'm willing to show up, and if I'm, you know, can maintain a degree of honesty, that really things will be okay. Things will be all right. And when I sat with this young woman out on my porch a week ago Friday, and I sat there and I listened to her, and she was in great pain, what I could say to her was, Anne, it will be all right. It will be all right. And I know that it will be. I know that it will be. I know many of us have to walk through a lot of grief, and a lot of us have been hurt and deeply wounded. And some of us will just have to walk through life with some wounds. But what I tell the women that I sponsor is this. Spin it into gold. Spin it into gold. Take that pain and spin it into gold. Because you become so valuable to the woman behind you when you are willing to share with her your strength and your hope and your experience, that you can take those days of pain and those days of grief, and you can spin it into gold for yourself and for others. And that's truly a gift of this program that I have learned and that I have seen in action. Nothing really changed for me until I did get that sponsor, until I did do a fourth step. Because up to that point, quite frankly, you know, those first three steps were very good for taking down my panic level. But really, it wasn't until I took responsibility for my own recovery that things began to change for me. In Al-Anon, we talk about the four M's, you know, mothering, manipulating, managing, and martyrdom. And I had to take a good look at those four M's and how active they were in my life. That I had spent all those years giving somebody the responsibility for my life, and it was never his to begin with. And then when he failed at it, I blamed him. And I was never a nag, and I was never a screamer. I just shut down. I just erased him as a human being, and that's an awful thing to do to anyone, particularly someone who is sick. And that's what you women helped me with. You helped me with that concept of the disease, that my husband was not a bad man, that my husband was simply a sick man. And you helped me when it came to my children, that my children were simply touched by the disease of alcoholism. They were not bad kids, and nothing that they did or said could I take personally. They were just sick. They were just sick. And not so long ago, my son, one of my sons, who's been in trouble with alcohol particularly since he has been almost 11 years old. When he was 17 last year, he was arrested. It's just, you know, a number of things. He's been sent away to Montana. He loved it. He came back clean and sober. He gathered all of his friends together and said, "I cannot hang out with you anymore. I'm not saying that I'm better than you are, but you're walking down a road that I cannot walk anymore." And, oh, my God, it was great. And then 6 months later, he's got a DUI. I mean, he just thought maybe he could drink a little bit, you know, and he couldn't. And he was arrested, drunk and disorderly, and thrown into juvenile detention and was placed under house arrest until he was 18 years old. And when I had to show up in court with him, this is my second son, actually, that I have had to sit in a courtroom and watch bring in handcuffs and shackles. Now, that's tough. That is tough. But thank God women who have walked in those shoes before me were willing to share with me. And really, it has made me a very valuable to a number of women who have to go through the same things. I tell them where to park. I tell them where, you know, how it works. You just walk in the room, and there'll be little lockers to your right, and you get a key, and you have to open it and stick your purse in there, and then keep the key, and then you get on the elevator, and you go up, and then they'll bring your son to you, and you've got about 45 minutes, and make sure he doesn't put his feet up in the furniture, because they'll tell him to put his feet on the floor. And so, blah, 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 blah. You know, you just learn this stuff, and the way that I have been taught is to think of it as spin it in the gold. Spin it in the gold. You become valuable. The worst things that happen to you in your life, the more valuable you become. That's what I tell the women I sponsor. They probably think I'm totally insane. But that's what I tell them. Wow, how valuable you are now. When I had to meet this one kid in the courtroom, however, the judge, who was really having a very bad hair day, said to me, "Can't you control your child?" And I said to her, "No, actually, I'm powerless." Well, they don't like to hear that one. And my son turned to me and he said, "I knew you'd say something smart." But I mean, truly, in all honesty, I am powerless over those kids. I can parent them as best I can, but as my sponsor says to me, if you make yourself your children's higher power, they will never find their higher power on their own. And I'll tell you this, those seven kids of mine, they have kept me on my knees, and they have kept me in a spiritual place I don't think I ever would have found without them. And I'm really very grateful to them for that, because they keep me humble. They keep me very, very humble. And it's when I did that fourth and fifth step that I really had to look at all those ways that I was really trying to control and taking on jobs that weren't mine. And being with you people, you are the ones that make me entirely ready to have God remove those defects of character. You are the ones that taught me one more time how to live the life I believe that we are all called to live. Now, I know some of you make fun of this thing that I say, but that's just what has always worked for me and with women that I sponsor. I never give advice. I don't give advice. What I do generally is ask women questions. Who is it that you want to be? Who do you believe that God is inviting you to be? Because this is just what I think, and this is just my opinion. I really believe that in each and every one of us, God places an idea of the kind of woman that we can be. And when you see a woman that has what you want, and I hope to God she's your sponsor, you recognize that in her because God gives you the grace to recognize it. You recognize the truth about yourself when you see it in someone else. And so when I'm dealing with my children particularly, I ask myself, what kind of mother do I want to be? And that's the kind of woman that I try to act like, even though I may not be feeling like her. That's the kind of woman that I try to act like. Because I don't know if I get another shot, you know. I'm just one that believes that this life is this life, you know. And I don't know if I'm going to have a second chance and come back in 20 or 30 years after I'm dead to try it over again. So I want to live this one as best I can. And so that's what I ask the women I sponsor. Who do you want to be? Right before I left, the woman that I sponsor said, oh, I hate this. I was talking to my ex-husband and I shrieked and screamed at him. I don't know what to do. And I said, Mary, do you have a vision of the kind of ex-wife you'd like to be? And she said, well, I haven't really thought about it. And I said, well, maybe you should. Think about her. Think about how she walks. Think about how she carries herself. Think about how she moves when she's in the presence of her ex-husband and his new wife. Think about what she says. And when you have it down, practice it. Practice it so that you can walk into her and you can become her. But until then, you know, be brief with him on the phone. I don't know what else to tell you, you know. Just be brief. Do the best you can. I think a lot of sponsoring is cheerleading. You know, it's about being a cheerleader. So you screamed and hollered at him and called him words that you don't like to use today. You screwed up, but you know what? You don't have to do that tomorrow. You're going to be great. You're going to be fine. You're exactly where you're supposed to be because you're willing to be better. You're doing wonderfully. And the other thing that I think is critical for a sponsor is you've got to be willing, I think, to share your own story with the women that you sponsor. Your hope, your strength, and your experience. I got a lot of things to tell the women that I sponsor. Times where I've really blown it. When I have really, you know, my oldest boy, who has been deeply affected by this disease, he doesn't come around much. I think we make him nervous. He doesn't come around much. But he came in 2 weeks ago. Do you know the first thing that came out of my mouth was? I said, Mark, you're huge. When did you gain all that weight? I mean, it's a boy. He is. He's huge. Really, it was raining when he left. I was going to offer him a Dixie cup to cover his head. His body is huge. His head is now this big. But I mean, it's like I didn't even realize that I had said it. So I had to make amends to him. When I talked to him the next time, I had to tell him I was sorry that I thought he looked like somebody put a bicycle pump in his ear and something. But before I knew it, I've shared that with women that I've sponsored since then. I have to make amends to my son, and I have. I'm deeply sorry. I had to make amends to my husband, too. I had to make amends that I was always, always asking him to do what was really, really was not his job. I had to apologize to him for my treatment of him. But more importantly than that, I had to change my behavior towards him, and you were crucial in that. You were crucial in that. Because you see, alcoholism took me into, you know, a great deal of isolation and self-pity, and you are the ones that have led me back into a world of compassion, and sisterhood. You really have. And so some years ago, my husband had this hobby of flying gyrocopters, which are really homemade helicopters, and I used to hate when he would go off, because he would leave me with all these kids, and it was really a resentment for me. But you were the ones that said to me, hey, if it makes him happy, why would you take that away from him? There's so little that makes the guy happy. If that makes him happy, let him go. Let it go. Everybody has the right not to recover. Let him go. And so because of you, one Memorial Day Saturday, he walked out the door. It was a gorgeous day, not a cloud in the sky. And I said to him as he was leaving, Rick, Have a ball. You have a beautiful day to fly. And those were the last words I ever spoke to my husband. Because two hours later, when I was coming up the driveway, the police were following me. And when I got to our house at the end of this drive, they told me to send the children in. And they said, "Mrs. Egan, is Rick your husband?" He crashed and died. And I remember my first thought, of course, was I turned and looked towards my house, and here are all these little heads. You know, at the time, the oldest child was only 14. And there are all these little heads in the little dining room with these little eyes. And I thought, oh, my God, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And at that moment, his mother, who was not well, was coming up the driveway. She saw the police cars. One of them went over to speak to her. And as I walked over to her, she, with her little cane on her wrist, held out her arms to me. And she took me in her arms and she said, "Thank God he's out of his pain." And just those words from this poor woman Rick was always her favorite child. You know how you love the ones that seem to suffer the most. Those words at that moment, really, it changed so much for me, because what she allowed me to do was to look at that in a different way. Because this guy, who really was so tortured by the disease of alcoholism, and I mean that, tortured by the disease of alcoholism, who had lost almost everything, the peace and serenity that he simply could not find here on earth, I know that he has now, as he is held in the arms of a loving and compassionate God. And that is enough for me. And my sponsor says that true faith is living your life without knowing the answers. And so when I went back to those kids, I have no idea what I did or how I did it, but I know this. I never stopped going to meetings. I never stopped being in constant contact with my sponsor. I never stopped working those steps. And one day at a time over these past years, my children have been okay. They have been okay. Now, a couple of them have ended up in juvenile detention. You know, all of them at one time or another have been arrested. But they've got a lot of spunk, that's all. They have a lot of spunk. Some of them been a little bit of trouble. Some of them been in huge trouble. But one day at a time, you have taught me how to raise these children by myself. And that's been a terrific gift. Sometimes these women that I sponsor, the single ones, will say, "I want to find somebody that's big and strong." And I say, "Well, I have an idea. Why don't you become big and strong? You know, I mean, why don't you become the man you're looking for? Then you'll never be lonely." You know? Now, I mean, that's not that I have anything against marriage, but, you know, you're just where you are when you're there, that's all. I mean, my father, before he died, said to me, "Remember, don't ever trust a man that would date a woman with 7 kids." And my dad was right. No, but I mean, really, I said, when people say, "What do you think you were married?" Well, I don't know. I always say to God, "Hey, just let me know. Let me know where you want me to be. And if today I'm here and I'm single, then that's okay with me. And if 10 years down the road you want me to be married, well, then that's okay with me. But in the meantime, I believe, and my sponsor is the one that backs me on this, I am enough for today. I am enough for today." And that's what I say to the women I sponsor. I'm enough for today. But I'll tell you why I don't give advice. My little friend Debbie, who got divorced, got out of an awful marriage, and really, it seemed to me, 2 days later was engaged. Really, I mean, 2 days later, I think she was engaged. And this is after I'm given this, you know, "You become the man that you want to find. You become the man that you want to find. You want flowers? Buy yourself flowers. It's great. And you don't owe yourself anything. It really worked out well. It's just great, you know? I don't like to be a fifth wheel. Oh, I love being a fifth wheel.
The only thing that's better than being a fifth wheel is being a third wheel. It's great. It's great. You can go where you want to go. You can go late. You can go early. You can stay. If you don't like the food, leave. I mean, it's great. Great. So I'm always giving these pep talks, you know. And, you know, 3 days later, she's engaged, and she comes to the meeting. And, I mean, I'm convinced this is the biggest mistake this woman can make in her life. And I'm not telling her not to do it, but, you know, I'm, you know, rah, 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 the single wife. So she shows up with this huge rock, and everybody in the meeting, I promise you, they went like this. Wow, what a rock. And then they all looked at me. Like, what in the hell have you let her do? Now, I'm going to tell you this. This was 2 years ago, and the woman is ridiculously happy. So what do I know? That's why I don't give advice. I just ask questions. What kind of parent do you want to be? Is that the kind of mother that you want to be? If it is, yeah, that's great. You know, if you want to go to court and throw things around and shriek and scream and roll on the floor and sob, hey, you can do that. You've done that. You can keep doing that. But if you want something else, if you want something else, then get that vision. Find that vision. I found my vision. And I have found her in these rooms. I have found her among the women that I know in both Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous. And she has what I want, and so I do what she does. I do what she does. And she has been very critical in my raising my children to be the kind of people I believe they want to be. But I, you know, they've got their own choices, that's for sure. My one daughter finally came to an Al-Anon meeting. Oh, I want to say 6 weeks ago. She was in a lot of pain. I said, Ellen, you know what I'm going to say? The whole family's been touched by this disease. I'm in Al-Anon. You know, I've got some that are in AA or have been in AA. But that's where I found my help. After 4 Al-Anon meetings, Ellen quits her big job. Guess what, Mom? I quit my job. Aren't you proud of me? I said, Ellen, you don't have another job. Well, you know what? I didn't like the kind of woman I was at that work. Well, that's great. Now she's jobless, but she's the woman she wants to be. She's so proud of herself. I said, Ellen, you got a vision of that woman at welfare department? Good. All right. Well, anyway. So, I don't know. You know, as Barbara said, I cannot tell you. I mean, to me, it's just really important to have that one person. I mean, I use a lot of people, but boy, there's nobody except for my sponsor who knows everything. Who knows everything. There is not a secret in my soul that my sponsor has not heard. There is no secret. And you know what? She still loves me. And that's a big deal for me. That's a big deal for me. That's why I like when my mother will say to me, why do you keep going to Al-Anon? Rick is dead. I would say, Mom, I keep going because, man, I'm not. I mean, I'm still living, you know? I'm still out there alive. So, I believe that each and every one of us is invited into a wonderful, intimate relationship with the God of our understanding. My invitation happened to come through alcoholism, and that's just the way that it is. But for me, I don't want any of my sponsees to think of me as their higher power, because I'm not. But I am willing to show them how I work the steps so that I have in my life now the main relationship in my life, which is the God of my understanding, which is the God of my understanding. And for me, what is critical is to carve out of my day quality time for prayer and meditation. Now, I mean, I've gone to meetings where I hear people say, well, you know, I pray at the grocery store. Well, that's great. But for me, I could never have a quality relationship with anybody if I only talk to them in a grocery store. I got to spend some time talking and listening, because I believe that that's really what it's all about. And one of my daughters graduated from St. Louis University a couple of years ago, and the speaker that day was talking about her 6-year-old son who had just come home from school and had learned the Lord's Prayer, and he wanted to recite it for her. And so she said, well, okay, go ahead. And he said, Our Father who art in heaven, How'd you know my name?
And that's the greatest thing that Al-Anon has given me. It's given me a God who I believe knows my name. And just as certainly as my name is carved in the palm of God's hand, I know with every breath in my body that the names of my children are carved there, and so are yours. And for that, I'm grateful. Thank you very much.